This is an ABC podcast.
Donald Trump's second term as US president has sent shockwaves around the world.
From this day forward, our country will flourish and be respected again all over the world.
At the start of 2025, he signed dozens of executive orders.
Concerns are growing among Pacific Island nations about the potential mass arrival of deportees from the United States. Only last week, US President Donald Trump signed an act allowing the deportation of any illegal immigrant.
The next item here is the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Treaty.
From cutting aid funding to pulling out of climate change agreements, moves that are putting vital programs around the Pacific at risk, like disease control in the Solomon Islands.
Since 2015, malaria has been increasing, and without this funding and such delays would actually be a catastrophic situation.
And it has climate activists around the Pacific sounding the alarm bells.
The Paris Agreement has really strengthened our fight on the ground to push for change, not just in our region, but it was something that we could all rally behind together as a global community. You know, America is no doubt one of the biggest countries contributing to the climate crisis. And so I'd say it was very important for America to be a part of the Paris Agreement.
Since first arriving on the political scene back in 2016, he's been shocking people with his divisive tactics. But how in that time has he influenced Pacific politics? And where will the Pacific end up down the track? Hi, I'm Scott Whitey, and this is Polytalk, where I'll take you behind the scenes of Pacific politics and how it affects us. Today, how US President Donald Trump's second term is shaping the Pacific. You'll hear from Jacinta Fa'amu about how climate activists around the region are responding to America leaving the Paris Climate Agreement.
There's also a bit of hope that communities there are not giving up and are still fighting and holding the line for climate justice, despite what's happening in their boardrooms.
And from Dr. Hugo Bugoro about what happens to malaria programs in Solomon Islands if money from the United States dries up.
The activities to mitigate communicable diseases like malaria is very, very important. I mean, we just cannot stand there and see people dying.
When Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, Pacific leaders like PNG Prime Minister James Marape responded by asking world leaders to focus on the global community and not just on national interests.
It is prudent that the biggest beholder of carbon footprints take greater responsibility. Much of the burden is being borne by those with the least carbon footprints. And there's a moral responsibility on each global leaders to think from a global perspective instead of from their own national interest perspective.
And it wasn't just Pacific leaders that were disappointed. Climate activists from around the region also felt the gut punch.
I was disappointed and maybe I was surprised, which is, a lot of people say, oh, I'm not surprised. But, you know, in this work, we have to have hope. And so because I had hope, I was surprised of the announcement.
Jacinta Fa'amu is the regional campaigner for 350 Pacific. And she says it was a painful moment. Because when the Paris Climate Agreement was adopted at the 21st COP back in 2015, the Pacific rejoiced.
My memory is a very positive memory because it was like a big win for our region. And so I kind of came into this movement seeing like a lot of people feeling like, oh, all their hard work is finally being paid off and celebrating such a huge win for the region.
At the time, Jacinta was brand new to the climate change action movement.
There was a poet who opened the climate summit. This was before the Paris Agreement was enforced. So I think it was the year before. And her name was Kathy Jitnell Kijana from the Marshall Islands. And she opened the climate summit with a poem called Di Matafele Peinam.
I would now like to share with you a poem that I have written for my daughter, Matafele Peinam. Dear Matafele Peinam, I want to tell you about that lagoon, that lazy lounging lagoon, lounging against the sunrise. Men say that one day that lagoon will devour you. They say it will gnaw at the shoreline, chew at the roots of your breadfruit trees, gulp down rows of seawalls, and crunch through your island's shattered bones. They say you, your daughter, and your granddaughter too, will wander rootless, with only a passport to call home.
Seeing a young Pacific Islander in the UN space talking about a promise to her daughter to, you know, save the future, and that there's a whole family and a whole village and a community behind her trying to stop the expansion of fossil fuels, that really resonates as a really, like, inspiring memory for me. So, like, learning about the Paris Agreement and what that meant as a, more as, like, a symbol for our region, and then having the visuals of this really, like, powerful poem from a young Pacific Islander. Yeah, my memory goes back very vividly, and I feel very blessed to have kind of come into the climate movement and experiencing that.
The Paris Climate Agreement is a legally binding treaty with the aim to limit global warming well below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, but ideally to keep it below 1.5 degrees to reduce the risk of climate change. In the years leading up to the signing of the agreement in 2015, Pacific climate activists had already put in a lot of legwork to bring attention to the climate change issue. And after the Paris Climate Agreement came into effect, Jacinta says they kicked into a higher gear, looking to keep countries accountable.
You know, the activist community from the Marshall Islands, who were basically one of the strongest communities supporting the Paris Agreement. And I know one of the big pioneers who pushed for the Paris Agreement was also from the Marshall Islands delegation. And so we have a lot to thank and have learned from the community in the Marshall Islands when it comes to building the groundwork of what the Paris Agreement means and what it looks like on the ground. And that's where that really strong slogan, 1.5 to stay alive, grew from. And I think it's a testament to their creativity that really inspired how, like, what it can look like to educate and inspire new people into this work and, like, grow that leadership from the communities and connect. So even though 1.5 can mean, you know, it's a very science statement, but a lot of our young Pacific climate warriors really made that into a strong narrative, connecting what that actually means on the ground, and created, like, really beautiful actions since then.
Jacinta, over the last decade, how much work have you and other Pacific climate activists put into climate work around the Paris Climate Agreement?
So in the last 10 years, I've been so lucky to witness how we educate our communities what 1.5 means, and then they kind of go away and plan and figure out, what does this actually mean for our people? What is it? What language do we need to use to communicate this to our communities? I've seen the power of using traditional knowledge, cultural dancing as a powerful tool to explain what this looks like on the ground. We've seen some really bold demonstrations, not just in front of politician offices, but even financial institutions in our Pacific diaspora communities.
What about behind the scenes with the amount of travel and legwork Pacific activists have done?
I think it's not just access to flights. It's like availability of when the planes are even available in certain parts of the Pacific. But yeah, whenever we plan a big campaign, a big chunk of that financially, even mentally preparing ourselves for it, is all utilized in our logistics space. So I always just think, when I see Pacific campaigns up on the mainstream, getting their work across to our communities, I always think, oh, I could just imagine the logistics behind the scene, because yeah, to fly sometimes for a lot of our volunteers or a lot of our warriors, traveling is, you know, very brand new. They're probably traveling for the first time. And so we're not just looking after them as they're traveling to different countries, but we're also making sure that they feel safe and feel comfortable in new places, even if they're only stopping by for a few hours. We need to make sure that they're fed and that accommodation is sorted. I think the logistics organizing from a Pacific perspective is a lesson that so many other organizations can learn from, because of the very restricted access to things we have when we consider traveling for our people.
And over the last 10 years, what role has the Paris Climate Agreement played in umpiring how countries respond to climate change.
The Paris Agreement has really strengthened our fight on the ground to push for change, not just in our region, but it was something that we could all rally behind together as a global community. It's played a huge role in amplifying a lot of our stories on the ground to mainstream. And I think it's also helped build a lot of powerful partnerships and collaborations across regions. We're seeing a lot of, you know, First Peoples and Indigenous communities collaborating with other Indigenous communities around the world. And I think that has been able to happen because of the incredible work that the Paris Agreement has done on a global level.
How did you feel when Donald Trump officially removed the United States from the Paris Agreement?
I remember, I was disappointed, and maybe I was surprised, which is, a lot of people say, I'm not surprised. But, you know, in this work, we have to have hope. And so because I had hope, I was surprised that of the announcement. The climate crisis is a huge problem that we all share. It's affecting all people's lives. And the Paris Agreement was just one way to help bring justice and solve the crisis together. And I just thought, why would you want to take that opportunity away? This is a global problem. It's going to require the whole global community to be a part of the solution. That sounds like a great thing to be a part of. Why would you take that away? America is no doubt one of the biggest countries contributing to the climate crisis. And so I'd say it was very important for America to be a part of the Paris Agreement. We recognize the climate crisis as the greatest security threat to the Pacific. And since the withdrawal, it really paints a picture of, how clear the signal for how much the US values the survival of people and especially in the Pacific region.
How have climate campaigners like yourself responded to this move?
Yeah, I think we've done a lot better now in managing, how and what we're responding to. So, we know people need time to fully process what's happening. You guys can stand over here, and whoever's ready to rock and roll can stand over here. And a lot of this has come from the lessons in the past where, we don't want to stay too long in, mourning what could have been. Tomorrow's another day. We've got to keep at it. And I think the most important thing is keeping the momentum in our communities, in the up. We also have to remind ourselves that the US is not the entire world. And, they're standing. Yes, it's disappointing, but, it won't dishearten us.
Climate change is the Pacific's biggest security threat, and its impacts are interwoven into the fabric of Pacific life. The United States is one of the largest carbon polluters, and its move to leave an international treaty keeping it accountable is disappointing to climate activists like Jacinta. But she says the region will continue to fight. President Donald Trump has also moved to drastically cut or pause funding from a number of key aid areas that flow into the Pacific.
Now, aid organizations have been left scrambling for answers after U.S. President Donald Trump's executive order to freeze aid funding for 90 days.
We're going to be looking at tremendous amounts of money being spent on things that bear no relationship to anything and have no value.
One of the organizations affected is Gavi, a multilateral agency that delivers critical vaccine programs to the Pacific, which will lose $2.5 billion worth of grants over the next 5 years.
In the Pacific region, since 2000, Gavi has supported a vaccination of about 100 million children. And currently, we know that post-pandemic, there's been an increase in children who are not vaccinated at all. So we call them zero-dose children, which means essentially they've not had any dose of vaccines. And we think there's about 500,000 children that are living that are completely unvaccinated. So these zero dose children in Gavi supported countries in the Pacific. So there's going to be a massive impact.
Meru Sheel, an associate professor from the University of Sydney, told the ABC.
Gavi is one of the key global agencies that is supporting the introduction of HPV vaccine in the Pacific Island countries. So that's a really important thing to remember. And as we talk about what things might get impacted, if there is a funding shortfall, lots of agencies, including Gavi, are going to have to think about what gets reprioritized. Is it going to be dropping funding to supplying vaccines to some countries? Is it going to be reducing the total number of vaccines in their portfolio that they support? Or is it reduced support or funding for vaccines and health system development? So it's going to be about reprioritization if there is this big funding shortfall that could likely happen if US doesn't support Gavi.
Another key organization losing out on funding is the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. The US was the largest contributor to the Global Fund, supplying up to one-third of its funding. And the pause on its contribution has scientists in the Solomon Islands concerned. Dr. Hugo Bugoro is the Director of Research and Postgraduate Studies at the Solomon Islands National University and is an expert in malaria studies. He says the Global Fund is the biggest external funding contributor to the country's fight against malaria, allocating $8 million between 2024 and 2026.
It supports the purchase of mosquito nets and also diagnostic tools.
Dr. Bugoro, what is the state of malaria in the Solomon Islands at the moment?
Since 2015, malaria has been increasing. Malaria is a major public health concern. It leads to significant illness and hospitalization in most cases among children under the age of 5 and also pregnant women. And the burden on the health system is high.
And how important is the Global Fund and the billions of dollars that the United States has historically given to the fund for the fight against malaria in the Solomon Islands?
Solomon Islands is actually heavily relies on external funding. Having these fundings actually maintains control efforts. It supports the purchase of mosquito nets.
With that pause in funding from the US to the Global Fund, what concerns does this raise about how it might impact on the fight against malaria?
Yes, so it will raise serious concern on this because it will disrupt supply chain for vital commodities like mosquito nets and medicine.
Outside the Solomon Islands, how could this funding freeze affect the Pacific region's fight against malaria?
We have neighboring countries, Papua New Guinea and one or two, that depends on this funding as well. A resurgence in one country could, you know, spill over to another. So it could make regional malaria elimination difficult.
United States has pulled back on its funding because it says it wants to focus on American interests. Why do you think that's important for the U.S. to help countries like Solomon Islands in this area?
I think it's really important that helping people, especially in the hard-to-reach areas, small islands who have that very limited funding to consistently maintain the activities to mitigate communicable diseases like malaria is very, very important. I mean, we just cannot stand there and see people dying.
Polytalk reached out to the Global Fund for comment, and they referred us to the Pacific Friends of Global Health.
Hi, my name's Helen Evans, and I'm an honorary professor at the Nossal Institute for Global Health at Melbourne University.
Helen, how has the U.S. aid pause impacted on the Global Fund and the delivery of programs in the Pacific?
Well, the U.S. funding pause has really created unprecedented uncertainty for health programs, actually health programs globally, because the U.S. is actually the biggest funder of health development funding in the world. The budget uncertainty is really very difficult, and the Global Fund is having to start to look at prioritizing decisions that'll inevitably infect essential services for malaria, HIV, TB, health systems, etc.
Alongside that uncertainty around the funding comes questions about the supply chains. What do we know about any disruptions to the supply chains at the moment and concerns about what could happen in the future?
Well, we understand that the Global Fund has emergency measures to maintain essential medical supplies in the short term, but we're really concerned about the sustainability of these supply chains in the longer term. So what we're talking about is critical commodities like anti-malarial medication, TB treatment, HIV treatments, and diagnostic tests. And they really require long-term predictable funding. And the uncertainty created by the US funding pause is already forcing difficult contingency planning throughout the Pacific region.
The Global Fund has earmarked $47 million for the Pacific region for 2024 to 2026. As part of that, the Global Fund has committed $8 million to the Solomon Islands for the fight against malaria. Will that funding continue?
Well, we understand that at this stage, they are planning to continue that $8 million. But as I was saying, in the broader context, the longer term sustainability of these programs is really now a serious question. And I think we've made huge progress in malaria over the last 20 years. There are about a quarter the number of deaths there were 20 years ago. But malaria comes back really quickly. Once you start stopping the control efforts, it can come bouncing back even within, you know, one wet season or bring it back. And that then leads to strains on health systems that are often fragile, such as in the Solomons and many of the Pacific Island countries. It increases deaths, and that's particularly amongst women and children, and that has a flow-on effect, not only to families, but to communities. It disrupts trade and tourism, so that exacerbates poverty, and that contributes to regional instability. I mean, it's a very salutary reminder that recently in the US, for instance, they've detected the first locally transmitted malaria that they've had there in 20 years. So it's a threat that hasn't gone away.
What will the long-term effects of this be for health security in the Pacific?
There's a cascading effect when you turn off the pipeline of research. So you're getting fewer clinical trials, fewer new treatments, fewer cohort studies, so you have less understanding of underlying causes and patterns of disease, etc. And the trouble is that when a crisis hits, you can't magically turn that on again. I mean, I think the mRNA platform is a good example. That was decades in the building, but it was there ready to go to develop the COVID vaccine. So cutting back on research like that has really major long-term implications.
President Donald Trump's shakeup of America's priorities has rattled the most vulnerable people in the Pacific and sparked concern for what's to come.
Well, there's a feeling of anxiety of what's happening in terms of the withdrawal of the U.S. aid, as well as America's policy towards climate change, for instance, and its engagement with the region and the world. So there's a lot of anxiety.
Dr. Stephen Ratuva is a distinguished professor for the Macmillan Brown Center for Pacific Studies at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. And he says Donald Trump's first and now second term as president has been a shock to the Pacific's political system.
It was quite a significant change from Obama. Obama was born in the Pacific, in Hawaii. He knew about the Pacific. And then Trump came in. He knew absolutely nothing about the Pacific. He didn't care. When Biden came in, he signed an agreement with the Pacific leaders in Washington. Again, part of the soft power engagement with the region. And now Trump is coming in. Like I said earlier, he doesn't know anything about the Pacific. He has no ideology, except that it's driven by the corporate interests and bringing in billionaires around him. So the interest in the Pacific wouldn't be geostrategic. It's not in his way of looking at the world. So it's a big shift.
Over the last 8 years, there are those that have found President Trump's policies hard to swallow, like climate change activists in particular. But there has also been part of the Pacific's population who have warmed to him. How have you seen that play out in the region?
Yes, one of the ironies, as a result of the growth of the evangelical movement, Trump has been actually quite popular amongst some of the Pacific people and leaders as well. So certainly, there would have been a boost by the victory of Trump. Particularly his statement that he's going to protect the Christian interests much more.
Has there been a swing towards more right-wing or conservative politics since Donald Trump has been in power?
It's been around the Pacific for some time, strongman conservatism, which is reinforced by some of the cultural traits as well, to do with the masculine culture and all those. Of course, colonialism was very much masculine imposition, so it kind of reinforced each other. And of course, Trump is seen as the ideal strongman leader.
President Trump's second term has been quite different to his first, moving swiftly to sign in executive orders, some of those pausing or cutting aid that impacts the Pacific and climate change action. What of these will have the most significant impact in the region?
I think the significant thing for the Pacific is the withdrawal of the United States from international agencies like the World Health Organization. From COP. COP is very significant for the region because of the issue of climate change. And climate change is very much part of the political narrative the security narrative, the development policies in the Pacific in relation to how you adapt and, of course, the mitigation process. And a lot of funding for global climate finance comes from the US as well. But now, with the withdrawal of the US, you're going to have an impact on climate funding in the Pacific. And of course, with the withdrawal of the US from the geopolitics from the Pacific, it also means that geopolitics is going to be significantly affected in terms of how it plays out in the region. China is watching, and I'm sure they are gleefully rubbing their hands saying, haha, it's time for us to go in and fill in the gap. So there's going to be a lot of changes in terms of the geopolitics, and Australia and New Zealand, being part of the Pacific and being closely aligned with the Pacific, will have to work extra hard in order to fill in that void.
How does the U.S. withdrawing from the region in this way, whether that is the pause on aid money or ending climate change commitments, set up in the region in a geopolitical sense moving forward?
Yeah, I don't think there'll be any upheaval as such, because I think the internal dynamics in the Pacific, they vary from country to country. Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, they're different in the ways in which the internal politics play out, and they've been able to sustain themselves, you know, despite the disruptions. So, but Australia has been expanding itself militarily, so it might want to fill in the gap which is left behind by the United States. And China, of course, will be playing out its cards. But for the Pacific Island states, they have been very smart, strategic in terms of playing one against the other, in terms of benefiting from both sides. So every country in the world plays that game anyway. They want the best for themselves. And economic development is very, very important. It's not a one-dimensional process where the big powers exploit the smaller ones. The smaller ones are probably smarter than the big powers to play their game as well.
Donald Trump's second term has sent ripple effects across the Pacific, from the corridors of climate change diplomacy to the front lines of public health. For scientists in the Solomon Islands, the United States fund freeze isn't just a headline, it's a health risk in a country where malaria is clawing back. America's retreat from the Paris Climate Agreement has hit hard for Pacific climate warriors, but it's also lit a new fire to keep fighting. But in the world of geopolitics, the Pacific has always been strategic. It has always been resilient. And it's clear, whatever storms come, political, economic, or climatic, Pacific communities are gearing up not just to survive, but to drive the agenda forward themselves. Politalk is hosted by me, Scott Waide. Our producer is Kunta Murray Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzna.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference.
Search up ABC Nisha Daily Afternoon Edition to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.